Nascar für Ankara, Ankara. When you talk it, you army be. Get money, money, make money, money, money. Welcome, kwanza, kwanza, meza, nindo, kisha, ni chane, kisha, nobody kama vipi, pisha, uone. Pumzi ndogo, ruchi, ndoku, wame, kwisha, kabisa, homie. Janja, kama, gombani, sababu, ye dem. Zime, mkwanja, wone, palivo, patamkwan. Wap, na piga, kaz, wap, chonte, chaki, makun, zapa, kuna, mapenz, zapa, dos, na kaz. Chapa, mchigo, pinga, bingo, bongo, paka, masaw, zitume, kaz, siyo, kama, jana, na jun. The A, Y, S, I, N, H.
CHRY, good afternoon. This is African Perspectives here on your community radio station, CHRY 105.5 FM. I'm your host today for African Perspectives, Ome Salma Rahemtula, and we are definitely in a good mood today. How the tables have turned in Egypt. So we will, of course, be discussing that a bit at the end of our show. But today's show will primarily be focusing on the secession of South Sudan. As many of you know, in early January, Sudanese people took to a vote, to a referendum, whether to the South should separate from the North of Sudan. And the results are in, and we will be discussing them with our guest. But we will start, as we always do, with headlines coming right up. Stay tuned. This is CHRY 105.5 FM, African Perspectives.
Yes, these are military minds, yeah? Kasoro zenye kasoro. Ifanye kama unajua. Ewa, Ewa, Hamifi, Sawa Sawa. You better act like you know. These are military minds, nigga. Yeah.
Ha, ha, habari no hiyo. Ha, ha, habari no hiyo. Ha, ha, habari no hiyo. Ha, ha, habari no hiyo.
And welcome back to CHRY 105.5 FM. And that in the background is the theme song for African Perspectives, Habari Ndio, which means that news. And that is what we're bringing. Here are our headlines from the African continent for this week. On Friday, Egypt's new Prime Minister Omar Suleiman announced that Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak was waiving rule after 30 years of dictatorship over the country, transferring power to the military. This announcement came after 18 days of mass protests by the Egyptian people who were calling for Mubarak's resignation. Throughout the almost 3 weeks of mass protests, Egyptians protested in the millions in Cairo's Tahrir Square, in Alexandria, Sinai, Aswan, Suez, and in cities all across the country. The crowd in Tahrir responded to Suleiman's statement on Friday by chanting, "We have brought down the regime." Mohamed al-Bardari, a prominent opposition leader, hailed the moment as being a dream come true. Al-Bardari retained that Egypt now needs to return to stability and proposed that a transition government be put in place for the next year. Ayman Nour, another opposition figure and a former presidential candidate, told Al Jazeera that he would consider running for the presidency again if there was a consensus on his candidacy. Egypt's new military rulers have pledged to enact a smooth transition to civilian rule amid celebrations marking the country's first day in 30 years without Hosni Mubarak as president. The Supreme Council of the Armed Forces vowed on Saturday to hand power to an elected civilian government in a statement that came after Mubarak was swept from power following the 18-day public uprising. The council also pledged to honor its international treaties in an apparent nod to the country's 1979 peace treaty with Israel. Later on Saturday, Egyptian state television reported that prosecutors had begun an investigation into three former ministers from Mubarak's government. Travel bans were imposed on former Prime Minister Ahmed Nassif and former Interior Minister Habib al-Adli, who were both sacked by Mubarak before he stepped down from the presidency on Friday. A travel ban was also imposed on Anas al-Faki, the information minister, who had been reappointed in a cabinet that had been swiftly sworn in as a concession to protesters. Shortly afterwards, Egypt's current Prime Minister, Ahmed Shafik, told a private Egyptian television station that al-Faki had resigned and that his resignation had been accepted. As you are surely aware, parties are sweeping across Egypt, but also in the diaspora. Here in Toronto, Egypt Canadians, as well as Egyptian Tunisians and other Arab Canadians and their supporters, took to the streets on Friday and on Saturday to celebrate the people's power and the resignation of President Hosni Mubarak. The celebrations took place at Young Dundas Square amidst flying flags of Egypt and Tunisia. Young Dundas Square had been the spot for Egyptian Canadians to come in the past 3 weeks to rally against the Mubarak regime in solidarity with their Egyptian brothers and sisters in the country. Algerian security forces and pro-democracy protesters have clashed in the capital, Algiers, amidst demonstrations inspired by the revolution in Egypt. Heavily outnumbered by riot police, at least 2,000 protesters were able to overcome a security cordon enforced around the city's May 1st square on Saturday, joining other demonstrators calling for reform. Earlier, thousands of police in riot gear were in position to stop the demonstrators that could mimic the uprising which forced out Egypt's Hosni Mubarak. Security forces closed all entrances to Algiers and arrested hundreds of protesters. Elias Filaili, an Algerian blogger and activist, said human rights activists and syndicate members were among those arrested at the scene of the protests. Officials banned Saturday's opposition march, but protesters were determined to see it through. Protesters are demanding greater democratic freedoms, a change of government, and more jobs. Earlier, police also charged at demonstrators and arrested 10 people outside the Algiers office of the opposition Rally for Culture and Democracy as they celebrated Mubarak's downfall. Millions of people in northern Kenya are facing hunger and an uncertain future as a drought continues to destroy their crops and livestock. The drought is also taking its toll on the population's health, and the number of malnourished and ill increase by the day. And there seems to be little respite. With no rains forecast over the next 3 months and the government saying that the country's food reserves are dwindling fast, some in this region might not make it through. A rebellion by former pro-cartoon fighters in the Upper Nile state of southern Sudan against giving up their heavy weapons has sparked 2 days of clashes, leaving 20 people dead and at least 24 injured. The fighting around Malakal Airport, close to the border with the north, began on Thursday when loyalists of Gabriel Tang, who commanded a pro-cartoon force during the 1983 to 2005 civil war, objected to surrendering their heavy weapons. The dead include 2 children and a Sudanese driver for the UN's refugee agency. The Tang loyalists are deployed alongside regular Sudanese armed forces in a so-called joint integrated unit with former Sudanese People Liberation Army, SPLA, forces that patrol the town under the peace agreement that ended the civil war. In reality, these units are far from integrated, and the component elements effectively operate as separate forces. The northern troops are shifting their equipment back home as the south gears up for its expected international recognition as an independent state in July, following its overwhelming vote for secession in last month's landmark referendum. The military warned there was a risk of more clashes as the country divided its forces before the south becomes independent. Peter Lamboth, Upper Nile's information minister, said fighting had also erupted in three other areas of the state on Sunday, in Palochi, Malut, and Maban. African leaders have begun talks in the Ethiopian capital to reach a common strategy on resolving Cote d'Ivoire's political crisis and tackling other continental trouble spots. More than 20 heads of state and governments were present at the opening of the two-day African Union summit in Addis Ababa on Sunday. Pre-summit meetings made a new proposal to task five heads of state to reach a deal to end Cote d'Ivoire's two-month leadership wrangle in which Laurent Gbagbo, the incumbent leader, is refusing to hand over power to Alassane Ouattara, his rival, following a presidential election. The panel would help Ouattara, quote, exercise power through a AU-negotiated deal. Ban Ki-moon, the UN secretary, who was also attending the summit, said a recount of the ballots would be a, quote, grave injustice. The summit was also expected to discuss the political turmoil in Tunisia and the protests in Egypt. Nelson Mandela, South Africa's former president, has been discharged for treatment at home, having suffered an acute respiratory infection. A convoy of security vehicles and a military ambulance carrying Mandela left the hospital on Friday, taking him to his home in Houghton, Johannesburg. Kgalema Motlanthe, the country's deputy president, said earlier that the anti-apartheid icon had undergone specialized tests in hospital and that there was no reason to panic over his health. Mandela was admitted to hospital on Wednesday, prompting health fears for the man who led South Africa as its first black president and is revered at home and abroad as a symbol of reconciliation and hope. The former president has had health problems in the past. He was diagnosed with tuberculosis in the 1980s while he was jailed and later had an operation to repair damage to his eyes. In 2001, he was treated for prostate cancer. Mandela was jailed for 27 years for his fight against apartheid and became South Africa's first black president in 1994. He stepped down after serving one term in 1999 and retired from public life in June 2004, just before his 86th birthday. Since then, he has rarely appeared in public, and when he did, he appeared increasingly frail. In addition to the Soccer World Cup final in July last year, Mandela appeared at a couple of ANC rallies before general elections in 2009. A leading Ugandan gay rights activist has been murdered at home just months after his photograph and those of several other people said to be gay were printed in a newspaper which called for them to be killed. David Kato, age 43, died on Wednesday after a man entered his home in the capital Kampala and struck him on the head before fleeing. Kato was pictured and named by the anti-gay tabloid magazine Rolling Stone that also ran a story late last year calling on readers to, quote, hang gay rights activists. Homosexuality is banned in Uganda, which is mulling a harsh new anti-gay bill that would usher in the death sentence for acts of, quote, aggravated homosexuality. Police are focusing on two potential suspects in the death of Kato. Nigeria's opposition parties failed to agree on a joint candidate to face President Goodluck Jonathan, the flag bearer of the ruling People's Democratic Party, in April's presidential elections. The inability to reach an accord comes ahead of a deadline for all parties to submit the nomination papers of their candidates to the Independent National Electoral Commission. Each party is at this time pursuing their fortunes separately, said the chief staff of the of the candidate for the Action Congress of Nigeria. And those have been your headlines from the African continent, credited to Al Jazeera and Pambazuka News. You are tuned in to CHRY 105.5 FM. This is African Perspectives. And remember, you can reach us. We would love to hear emails from you, feedback on our shows, suggestions for other shows. And our email address is africanperspectives@chry.fm. That's africanperspectives@chry.fm. And we do have also a blog, which we post all our archive shows on. And you can check that out at afri-perspectives. That's afri-perspectives.blogspot.com. And you are tuned in to CHRY 105.5 FM. We're going to take a quick community listing break and be back with Farid Omar, who's going to speak to us about South Sudan. Stay tuned. And we are back here on CHRY 105.5 FM. And I am joined on the line by Farid Omar. Farid Omar is a consultant, freelance writer, and a researcher at the York Center for International and Security Studies. And he's going to be speaking to us today about the referendum in Sudan and the wider implications. Hello, Farid.
Hello, Omar.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for bringing me in.
Okay, so first I'd like to ask you, as we all know, from January 9th to the 15th, Sudan had a referendum to decide the fate of the south of the country. The results of the referendum show that the people of the south have voted overwhelmingly to secede from the north. Can you give us a bit of a historical context for this referendum, what brought it about, and, you know, the history between this kind of north-south divide?
Yeah, it goes back to the long-lasting post-colonial conflict in Sudan that has been going on since 1956 when Sudan became independent. Initially, the conflict was in the form of political tensions between North and South before it turned violent in the 80s. In 1972, there was the Addis Ababa peace deal between the North and South, in which it was agreed Southern Sudan will have autonomous status and there will be power sharing in all levels of the government and also in the military. And it worked well for almost 10 years, from 1972 to 1983, I think 11 years during Jafar Numeri's reign. There was calm peace in Sudan. I think it's the only decade that there was peace in Sudan. But in 1983, Numeri decided to unilaterally cancel the peace deal with the South, and he imposed Sharia law in the South, despite the fact that it is mainly Christian. And then the SPLS, Southern Sudanese People's Liberation Army, under John Garang was formed, and the armed conflict in the south began. Initially, it was all about political accommodation and autonomy for the south. But as the conflict raged on, the SPLA declared that it was fighting to secede from Sudan. And the war continued from 1983 to 2005, when the comprehensive peace agreement between the North and South was signed in Kenya, in Machakos, and then later in Nairobi, Kenya. The CPA, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, committed both the North and South to the holding of a referendum within 5 years, which was actually held January this year, to determine whether the South will remain in the in a unified Sudan or secede from the North. in that interim period, there was power sharing between the North and South, of which the SPA leader initially, John Garang, became the president of Southern Sudan, but also it was still part of Sudan, which means he was also the vice president of the larger Sudan. But he died in a helicopter crash after 6 months, and he was his position was taken by Salva Kiir, who is the current president of South Sudan, and who in the last 5 years was the vice president of Sudan. So the referendum took place in January, as you mentioned, and the overwhelming majority in the south, up to 99%, have decided to separate from the north.
And before we get to talking more about the referendum and its implications, I wanted to just turn a bit more to this north-south conflict and ask you, the conflict between the north and south has been presented in the mainstream media as a racialized conflict, right? That it pits Arab Muslim north against a Christian black south. Can you just elaborate a bit on how this allows for particular racist and Islamophobic interpretations of the conflict and distorts what's really going on in the region, distorts the fact this is really, as you mentioned, a post-colonial conflict? And then how does that influence the referendum and how the referendum is portrayed in the mainstream media? And I'm thinking the stupidity that's going on, honestly, is all I can call it, with like George Clooney, and like it's like a Hollywood bonanza in Sudan right now. So can you talk a bit more about how the mainstream media, portrays the conflict and how that leads to how the referendum is being looked at?
Yeah, it is true. The conflict in Sudan was primarily political, but the Western media was responsible in terms of the negative, the false representation of conflict being that of Arab North, Arab Muslim North, and Christian animist African South. So the main idea was to drive a wedge between Arabs and Africans. Even historically, Sudan is primarily an African country. Even in the North, the majority of people, like the Nubian people, are still African people, but they are portrayed as Arabs in the Western media. So it was to drive a wedge between Arabs and Africans in Sudan, but also Muslims and Christians in Sudan, but even more so to drive a wedge between Afro-Arab solidarity. We can remember with the situation in Palestine and Southern Africa, where the struggle against apartheid was closely linked to the struggle for Palestinian homeland to end the occupation in Palestine. So that was one of the reasons that the Western media and Western nations portrayed this conflict in negative light. It was primarily political. It was about political accommodation of the South. It was about political autonomy for the South, in the context of a united Sudan. You spoke about Clooney and others. We never saw them when 5 million people died in the genocide in the Congo. So no Hollywood celebrity came to address the issue in Congo. And this is the double standards, because the conflict in Congo was orchestrated by the West, by the U.S., which was looking for the control of the minerals, especially in eastern Congo. And because the West had a direct hand in the conflict in Sudan, in Congo, then we don't see these celebrities or the Western media talking about the genocide in Congo. So that's a sad reality about the conflict in Sudan. Even in Darfur, people are told it's about black Africans and Janjaweed. There is nothing like that. The so-called Janjaweed are African people. They are hardly Arab people in Darfur. So it is another misrepresentation of the conflict in Sudan. The strategy of the West was to put pressure on al-Bashir to agree to the referendum by threatening him with war crimes in the South and also in Darfur. And I think he cracked under that pressure. And so that's why we see the North was pushed into this referendum and the south, there are still people in the south who wanted a unified Sudan. And this is what we don't hear in the mainstream media. There were a lot of young activists who are part of the Al-Wahda movement. Al-Wahda means unity in Arabic, which called for a unified Sudan, in which a united Sudan, a united democratic Sudan, can stand against imperialism instead of having two Sudans, north and south, which will weaken the Sudanese people on both sides of the border to the dictates of Western imperialism.
And Farid, in a recent article you wrote for the Socialist Worker, you argued that Western interests in oil, especially reserves in the South, have played a major role in the South referendum. So can you tell us a bit more about this?
Yeah, it's true. Because there's a new player in Africa now, China, which in part has huge concessions of oil in Sudan, especially in the South. The West was losing its grip on African resources, including oil. So the strategy of the West was to win back those resources in Sudan, especially oil. But also, South Sudan has minerals as well, like uranium, magnesium. It is rich also in timber. So the best way for the West to win back those resources in South Sudan is to orchestrate a breakup of Sudan. If the South breaks up, it will mean China has to renegotiate all those deals with the South, because it is a new independent entity. And what the South will do is it can abrogate those deals, because it says those deals were signed by the North, and now Sudan is a new sovereign state. And even initially, it can nationalize those resources, pending takeover by Western corporations. So the U.S. had worked overtime very hard to orchestrate the breakup of Sudan, in which South Sudan will be a new ally, a new friendly nation in that region, and of which the South will be forced to cancel its contractual agreement with China, and then grant concessions to U.S. and other Western European oil corporations. So it was largely the U.S. interest in the referendum was largely to orchestrate this breakup of Sudan so that it can have direct access to oil and other vital resources in the South.
So this is, I mean, what it ends up being then. I mean, we're framing this referendum really geopolitically, right? Yep. So if you could maybe just talk about a bit more the role that China has in the Sudan, right? Like, where are they mining? You know, and what kind of relations are these, right? This is a bit of a conundrum, not a conundrum, but it's a difficult for us to, as African people, analyze, like, what is the role of China, not only in Sudan, but wider, continent-wide. So how can this kind of add to that conversation, and what exactly is China doing in the Sudan?
Okay, China has the majority, or 80% of the oil concessions in southern Sudan. But it's not limited to South Sudan. Like, it has many mineral concessions in the rest of Africa. It's also involved in massive trade deal with Africa. A lot of people in Africa will argue that they have a different relationship with China, because China can help them break away from neoliberal bondage, because it does not impose Western systems of governance on Africa. It does not entirely exploit African resources, but gives back in terms of providing grants, not loans. It's also involved in building of infrastructure like roads, highways, power plants, things that Western nations don't do in Africa. So there is that debate: should Africa ally itself with China as a way of breaking up with the West, or is China also extending its influence on Africa as a new colonial power? But I think the majority of the people think that Africa stands to benefit more from China because it is investing in African infrastructure and also subsistence agriculture, which is very, very important in terms of food security in the African continent. So they see China as an ally, being a member of the South, being part of the global South, with similar development experiences with southern nations. So that debate is still on, and that China should have, like Africa should have a closer relationship with China as opposed to the West. And now people think that there is a new scramble for Africa, in which now the West is trying to reassert its influence in Africa, South Sudan being a classic example of that unfolding.
And just, I guess, one more question on China. Like, I think it's important that we bring this into the conversation, right? Because we're not seeing that anywhere else. And as you say, we can see in other examples that, China is really threatening the hegemony of the West. And we can see that clearly in the Darfur conflict, right? When the West was accusing China of holding back, whatever reconciliation in that region in terms of their vote in the UN.
Yes, this is another area because Africa believes that China can support Africa's interests on the world stage in international forums like the United Nations, the World Trade Organization. So it is not just limited to the question of South Sudan, but when Africa needs concessions from the West, then China can be a partner. Africa doesn't have a permanent representative in the United Nations, so China can be an ally that can use its veto at the United Nations to push through Africa's agenda in the United Nations. So for many African leaders, it is a strategic relationship with China in terms of having a voice in the international arena, especially in the United Nations. The U.S. talks about China versus human rights. I think that's double standards, because if we look at the history of imperialism, the U.S. is the biggest exporter of state terror. We can see the situation in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in the Congo. It has contributed to, it has instigated imperialist-driven wars in the continent. It has facilitated the evolution of brutal dictatorships, the likes of Mubarak, Mobutu, Suharto, who have subjugated and repressed their peoples brutally, simply for protecting U.S. interests, geopolitical interests in different parts of the world. So I think China will be a strategic partner for Africa in the international arena, like the United Nations, in terms of pushing its agenda through. So I think that's what the U.S. is trying to resist, and Western nations, but I think that strategic partnership will continue.
Okay, and now hopefully now we can move maybe more to the referendum now that we have this very strong context. So what are the, or how do you see the post-referendum unfolding in terms of South Sudan and secession? We hear, a whole bunch of things, and I really don't know myself how to look at it. We hear that, the South cannot survive without the North. Well, al-Bashir is saying whatever the South decides that he will comply with. What are the prospects now for the South and for the timeline of July as the date for secession?
First of all, peace between the North and South cannot be reality until the disputed status of Abyei is resolved. Abyei is an oil-rich region which is located on the North-South border. This has not been resolved because it is expected that the Abyei region will hold its referendum in future. It was not part of the CPA monitored referendum. So this is a potential flashpoint. A lot of people fear that this could again reignite North-South tension. It can lead to North-South conflict. Let's say if the referendum goes in favor of the North, the South will feel shortchanged. If Abia vote in favor of remaining in the South, then it could still trigger a conflict between the North and South. So between now and July will be very crucial in terms of the North and South negotiating a peaceful settlement on the issue of Abia. Another disturbing trend is internal crisis in the South. Already, there have been clashes in the South between HPLA forces and a rebel faction, a splinter group from the HPLA. In the last 1 week alone, 105 people have died, and this is because a former HPLA general, whose name is George Arthur, who comes from the Jonglei state in the northern part of South Sudan, alleges that in the regional election in South Sudan that took place last year, April 2004, President Salva Kiir of the South rigged the election in favor of his rival. So there were clashes last year, although there was a ceasefire and they agreed to be part of the referendum. But clashes broke out again when Arthur claimed that his group was attacked by the SPLA because the SPLA wanted him to disarm. He still has some militia under arms. In post-referendum Sudan, they expect other groups to disarm. So the problem is that the SPLA has not been able to deal with the internal divisions. These divisions existed since 1991. When Riek Machar broke away from the SPLA and joined the Northern Alliance of Parties and briefly fought against the SPLA, but then later on rejoined the SPLA that was previously led by John Garang. So I think it's a difficult situation for the SPLA in terms of unifying within its own ranks, and this can potentially become more dangerous when it comes to control of resources after July, when the South officially becomes an independent state. So it is important that in this transition period between now and July, that South Sudan tries to reach a political compromise with the North on the issue of ADA, even before the referendum is held, and also for SPLA, to try to unify within its ranks so that it does not suffer from remnants or splinter groups taking up arms and threatening security internally in southern Sudan. So it is a wait-and-see game now. We don't know what will happen, but the sounding alarms are there. But we hope that there's a peace in the South, regardless of the geopolitical challenges I spoke about. We hope that there is finally peace in the South, and also peace between the North and South, and that peace returns to the region as a whole.
Fadi, thank you very much for joining us. I'd like to ask you just a few more things before we end the interview. First, where can our listeners read the article that you wrote in I think it was the Socialist Worker?
Oh, they can go to www.socialist.ca, and then they will see the Socialist Worker newspaper, and they can go to the current issue. And when they go to the current issue, they can browse, and they will find my article there, Sudan, a Nation Split by Oil. So www.socialist.ca.
And
or you can Google Socialist Worker.
Sorry. And is there anything else that you would like to add in terms of the discussion that we might have missed talking about?
Well, it's just about, regional leaders like in Africa, I think, should not wait. They should try to continue with a new, like, in post-CPS framework, try to resolve any internal divisions that may arise in South Sudan, as well as mediate between the North and South, try to find a solution for the RBI dilemma. So I think, like I said, this crucial period is very crucial between now and July to sort out those issues that were left out of the CPA, which was pushed through very fast without taking into consideration that there are some internal problems that need to be solved in the South, and there are some outstanding issues between the North and South. So the African Union should continue to play a proactive role. It should not just assume everything is fine now that the referendum is over. It should engage both the North and South Sudan to try and find a lasting solution.
Fadi, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Ome. Thanks a lot.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye.